Welcome me back to the Damage Report, everyone. It's John Adirola. I'm back. It's been months and so much has happened. We're going to get into it, as well as all of the big news of the day, as I once used to do. But first of all, before we jump back and everything, I do want to thank those who made it possible for the show to still be here. I didn't have to return to like a smoking ruin. And one of those people joins me now. Host of the Bituation Room, Francesca Fiorentini. How's it going?
Return of the dad once again. Return of the dad. Pump up the world. Or your boobs. Sorry.
I'm not mine.
Not yours. Welcome. Yeah. I mean, the people who kept this afloat, obviously, were Mike and Ashley, the producers.
You, Ravana, JR, all of the other like people who joined the show and occasionally hosted. Everybody's so great. I was able to leave
for three months.
That's crazy.
I know. How are you feeling? By the way, can I say that you told me you were nervous? So everybody, John's feeling butterflies.
Well, the thing that makes a person feel less nervous is having a live audience told that you're nervous. So yes. I definitely feel much better now. As we're going to get into in our bonus content, which we're going to resume. So we're going to be doing our little top 10 list after the show for our members on YouTube. And we're going to be doing months ago, before I went on leave, like a month before I went on leave, we did a little like what I would like to do during my time off during the 12 weeks. We're going to revisit that and see how it went. But one of the things did have to do with like keeping up with the news and everything. And like you suggested, you know, making sure that you do disconnect a little bit. The thing is, I 99% disconnected. So like I was not following things other than a few of the big things that you can't avoid. So I do feel a little bit disconnected. During our production meeting this morning, I blanked on Lauren Boebert's name, which is fine. And then I blanked on Matt Walsh's name, which is one of the greatest experiences that I've had in years, other than maybe the daughter. Maybe a little bit better than having my daughter. I couldn't remember his name for a solid minute. And that was great because I had no idea what he'd been saying. So I'm a little bit, I have nerves because I've never taken this sort of break. Like the last time I was even gone for more than 2 weeks was when I was in the Arctic and TDR didn't even exist then. So I'm just a little bit worried about my ability to like, you know what's going on, remember facts and everything. A little bit worried about that.
And you're a dad now. And that's so exciting. Literally. And congratulations. Yeah. If we haven't all said it to you, she's adorable. Congratulations. Welcome, Raina. Your dad's awesome. So
I was saying this during before the show went live. Like I want to be holding her right now. Like I keep running back in. I'm in my shed, obviously, in the backyard. I keep running back in to like hold her. Because this is gonna be like the longest I've been away from her for 12 weeks.
I like that you're streaming in a shed in the backyard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, what does your dad do? Oh, he mostly streams in the shed in the backyard. Cool.
Anyway, I'll try to make it sound cooler by the time she gets into school. But but anyway, very excited to be back here. Very excited to be doing the news once again. Obviously, there is a lot going on. Some of it light and fun. Republicans making fools out of themselves in Florida. Trump testifying in his civil fraud trial. And then there's other news, which we're going to be getting to very soon, which it's the worst. Sometimes the world is the worst. Thank you, Francesca, for covering so much of that sort of news while I was gone, by the way.
No problem. I mean, there's plenty of it to go around.
So yeah, 100%. We do have a lot that we're gonna be talking about. Some of it fun. We're gonna go a little bit lighter once we get into the aftermath, as always. We're gonna be starting off super serious, and I can see a lot of comments, super chats, all of that coming in. Thank you so much, everybody, for being so welcoming to me coming back, being so welcoming to everybody filling in while I was gone. But with that, should we get this thing started?
We should.
I used to have a way that I would say that.
No.
I don't remember it anymore.
Are you ready to jump in or something like that?
Something like that. I don't know. Maybe someone can remind me. I think
you were just singing like, let's get it started in here by the Black Eyed Peas.
Probably.
But you sang the not censored version and it was weird and we had to like pretend you didn't say that.
Okay. I feel at home again because of the way I'm being treated. Anyway, with that said, let's tighten it up, everybody, and jump into only the most serious sort of news. Israel, 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 Israel,
waste, more innocent lives are massacred. It's the biggest injustice of our lifetime. And the least thing we can do is make ourselves uncomfortable in solidarity and plead to the world to find our humanity and to end this injustice.
So what you're seeing there is just a little bit of footage from the many protests that have been obviously ongoing for many weeks now, but they have not slacked off literally at all around the world. Tens of thousands, far more people marching, either large marches, speeches, gatherings, demonstrations like you saw, and tend to make clear the devastation that is ongoing. Literally as we broadcast this right now, the military operation continuing in all of its obvious barbarity. The death toll inside of Palestine has now soared past 10,000. Obviously, depending on who you talk to, the number is going to be different, but nobody can deny that this is an absolutely apocalyptic death toll, both at large and also specifically the number of Palestinian children that have been killed during the ongoing violence that despite international condemnation, more so than condemnation coming specifically from the US government, shows no sign of stopping, and it is possible that the worst is still to come. It is at very least good to see that people are letting their voices be heard. They understand what's happening, despite the mainstream media often having a particular spin on these sorts of stories historically. And so it is good to see that people are, you know, making good on their values and not being quiet about what we continue to see. Francesca, I know that you've been talking a lot about this while I was gone on family leave. What do you think about these protests and this dark milestone of more than 10,000 dead?
I mean, it is so grim, and yet that was the biggest march for Palestinian human rights in American history in DC over the weekend. So at once, it's incredibly depressing and also heartening that at least the people, not our leaders, understand what is going on. And the other thing that happened simultaneous is that Netanyahu was basically like, yeah, thanks, Blinken, you know, for the whole like humanitarian pause suggestion. I'm gonna go with no. So you're absolutely right. This shows no sign of slowing down. In fact, it is ramping up, and there will be even more of a ground incursion into Gaza. 10,000 dead. You're looking at, by a lot of estimates, that if and when the territory is reclaimed by Israel, there could be as many as 25 to 30,000 people killed, to say nothing of those displaced, those who are dying of hunger right now, of thirst. The cancer ward, y'all, you know, in a hospital in Gaza, the pediatric cancer ward was targeted by Israel over the weekend. I mean, the depravity. Just as soon as you think, no, doesn't get worse than this, it gets worse. It gets more depraved, as if somehow this is still an act of self-defense. So, I mean, I am so broken, and it's so hard, John, because before when I would produce it, I could cry sort of as I was producing, get very upset. And now I have to, like, you know, get live, hit with it live on air. So apologies in advance, but it is very intense.
100%. I'm glad that you pointed out, obviously, medical facilities, hospitals still being targeted. Some of you are probably wondering when that is going to come to an end. My dark prediction would be when there are no hospitals remaining in Gaza. That's probably when the hospitals will stop being bombed. Same for refugee centers. I saw estimations of, you know, if this 10,000 number is accurate, proportionally, what percentage of the population that is, and they estimated it's akin to 1.5 million people being killed in the United States, which is conveniently similar to our COVID death toll. So in the span of just a handful of weeks, it is an effect on the population, just in terms of death, let alone injuries, families broken, infrastructure destroyed, and all of what's going to come from that, akin to the worst domestic like policy public health failure in US history over the course of years, shrunk it down in the span of less than a couple of months. Devastating in a way that is hard to actually articulate. And imagine, even if, let's say, that the calls for a ceasefire, or for people who, for some reason, I don't understand why, I'm just coming back to the news after 3 months away, why some people can't say the term ceasefire, humanitarian pause, all this stuff. What is the games that we're playing with rhetoric these days? A ceasefire is what's needed. But even if we had a ceasefire, well, infrastructure of all different varieties has been utterly destroyed. There's been effectively no medicine, no food getting in. When you can talk about a couple of dozen trucks making it in as progress, that just goes to show how devastating everything is. Jordan recently airlifted in some medical supplies. But even if all of it ended right now, You have now locked in untold suffering and deaths from the fact that the infrastructure, especially the medical infrastructure, isn't there. So we have passed this milestone, but we already know that this is just like when we would talk about COVID, it's an almost meaningless number, right? Because it's just a preview of what we're going to be talking about in a few weeks or a few months.
Absolutely. There's so much to say. And, you know, John, the other thing we covered when you were away is that Blinken basically said there's no there's no military solution to this. So even Blinken admits there's no military solution to this. And so what's the answer? The answer is diplomacy. The answer is negotiation. The answer is Hamas reportedly is willing to exchange all of the hostages. This is just new. All the hostages for a ceasefire. Now we have to like triple check that, but like what is being done to save the Israelis and American citizens who are still being held by Hamas? Yeah. Nothing, right? They are once again, collateral damage. So this isn't about Israel versus Palestine or what. This is about our leaders. This is about our leaders failing to protect human lives, and especially being willing to trample Palestinian lives.
Yeah.
I mean, this could, John, we're going to talk about blowback in so many years, man. You and I, it sucks, but this is like, we're going to get into, you know, this is going to define the region and our understanding of it from obviously a progressive, in my opinion, an anti-war perspective. We're going to have to be dealing with the effects of this for a very long time, domestically, internationally. Mm-hmm. So yeah, tuck in.
Yeah, and look, obviously the region's been chaotic. There's been violence for a very long time, longer than we've been alive. Everybody knows that. But now, I mean, those prior incidents, crises, conflicts just seem so utterly minor compared to what we've already seen, let alone what appears to be coming. This major operation is still underway. You know, while we were producing, Israeli military said that they had cut off Gaza City. I mean, God only knows what's going to come from that. I hadn't seen that about the offer to return the hostages. Obviously, I hope that that can happen because I can only imagine, you know, what people inside of Israel, friends and family members must be feeling. Just the hope that those hostages might still be alive. The fear, perhaps, if it occurs to people, that those hostages might have been killed by the ceaseless bombing of the Israeli military. Almost certainly some of that has happened. It's almost unthinkable. It's so terrible. But unfortunately, while there have been, you know, we have these protests, we have, you know, in the UN, major vote, there are people who are trying to call for a ceasefire. And you can go to ceasefiretoday.com for a variety of different resources having to do with this, and hopefully to pressure our US representatives to call for a ceasefire. A number have, thankfully. In fact, my representative, Maxine Waters, just did in the last day. There have been some who have. There needs to be far more. Joe Biden obviously could be doing far more. We're the largest, richest, most powerful country in the history of countries, and we have no influence. We have no power. We can't actually change the situation at all. We can send a dude and he can go and he can talk to someone and then say, oh shucks, nothing happened. But I guess that's all we can do. I guess that's all that we can hope for, to save lives on both sides, by the way, if that's what you're actually interested in. We could do that. But you don't see much of it. And by the way, this is like the least important part of this story. But if you are Joe Biden, you should also consider the possibility that even if you don't care about the human toll, like politically, registered voters in battleground states trust Trump over Biden on managing the conflict by 11 percentage points, even young voters. So like, even if you don't care about the human toll, like for your own skin, maybe try a little bit harder, try to resolve this thing, because it feels to me like what we've seen in many other cases, Francesca. It feels like just going to sort of stand back and I hope it doesn't end up too bad, because I'm not going to do anything to actually improve the situation. That's my fear at this point.
Biden's so weak. I mean, it's just so sad how weak he is in this instance. And yeah, while at the same time, here's $14 billion worth of weapons, Israel. But please, humanitarian pause? No? Okay, you can have it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, just a lot about this that I will never understand. Unfortunately, that we have a lot of other aspects of this to get to, so we are going to move on. We want to move now to a little bit of that pressure that I was talking about. Some progressive legislators like Rashida Tlaib have been ramping up their rhetoric against those who could do something to stop the violence that we're seeing. Take a look at this video targeting Joe Biden.
We stand with Israel. innocent civilians are going to be hurt going forward. I wish I could tell you something different. I wish that that wasn't going to happen, but it is going to happen.
I want to thank President Biden for his unequivocal support.
We will remember in 2024.
So obviously very strong video telling Joe Biden, if you choose to just take a backseat to this whole situation, then there are going to be electoral consequences for you. It's a message that I think makes a lot of sense. It represents what a lot of people here in the United States and around the world are feeling right now. But she used the word genocide, Francesca. And so that's the only thing that anyone's going to focus on. Forget all the rest of the stuff. Now it can be a scholarly rhetorical argument about whether that term is exactly appropriate to use, and that's going to be it. So we're going to get to how this is now being used to pressure people like Bernie Sanders and his sort of middling response to it. But first of all, what did you think about Representative Tlaib's video?
Incredibly powerful and really, really gutsy. I mean, to say this and put it out there, especially being someone who's already demonized by other centrist Democrats for being a squad member, for being, you know, for Medicare for all, for talking about things like, you know, US-Mexico border reform, and also for being Palestinian and for being Muslim and for being a woman and all of the things, and to say this. And I think it's really important for those of us who are not Arab or Muslim American to really understand how this feels to those communities, and understand that in 2024, this is not about whether or not you think Trump is better. I think most people know Trump would be far worse, especially when it comes to foreign policy. And Trump absolutely demonizes Muslim Americans, you know, wants to ban all of them, etc. But this is about feeling like your community is completely under attack and your president does not care. President doesn't care. Fine to just inflame a massive regional war in a place where you or your parents hail from originally. Fine to put you at risk to have a 6-year-old killed, stabbed 27 times because of the kinds of right-wing rhetoric and the kinds of centrist and warmongering rhetoric that this administration participates in and is engaging in and is funding. So
yeah,
viscerally, how can you bring yourself to vote for Biden? If the election were tomorrow, I would be incredibly scared for him. And Rashida Tlaib is saying, look, I'm from Michigan. These are states that you won by a slim majority, and that Muslim and Arab American vote could be the difference, 10,000, 20,000 votes of you being reelected.
Yeah, well, and as we're going to get into later in the show, there are a lot of reasons to be concerned about that. So maybe he should be paying attention. That said, as I alluded to, Bernie Sanders was asked about these videos, and we want to get into as much of his response as we can. So here's the first question.
What's going on right now is a horror show. We don't have to quibble about words. Thousands of men, women, and children are being killed. It has got to end right now. And one of the things that concerns me, Donna, is there has not been enough talk about what right-wing Republicans are doing right now. They don't want any aid to go to the Palestinians. Somebody should be talking about that. Somebody should be talking about how Trump wants to expel Palestinians from this country. So it's, you know, you can disagree with Joe Biden, but on his worst day, it'll be 100 times better than where Trump and the right-wing Republicans.
So look, everything that Senator Sanders says there about Trump and about the Republicans is obviously true. We're going to get into a little bit of that in a bit, but yet they're not in charge right now. I mean, they're in charge of the House, but they don't have the presidency. So I don't know, it feels like a needless evasion. It can be 100% true and also not what we need to be focusing on right now. I understand that Bernie Sanders is, in the way that he has across so many issues over the last few years, sort of trying to work with or influence Biden, but we also know how utterly ineffective that has been in a lot of different cases. So I think it makes sense to me, at least, to question the strategy. He talks about not wanting to quibble on, you know, with language and everything. Okay, I guess I think that sometimes a strong, clear message is necessary, and it seems weird to me how free President Biden and representatives of the US government have been to talk about similar, in some cases even less violence of this sort in the Ukrainian context, and been very clear about what Putin is aiming to do. Some of the people are doing mashups of Blinken talking about civilians being targeted in both cases. And it is striking how different the tone is, how fatalistic and apathetic about the violence continuing right now in Gaza. It's like, yeah, what are you going to do at this point? It's okay, maybe not that bad, but it's bordering on it. And so I don't know. I mean, giving a pass to people who seem to be giving a pass to this violence is not the look that I would want from Bernie Sanders, who I want to be serving as a leader in the same way that Rashida Tlaib is on this issue.
Yeah, really quickly, because I know we have to, you know, move on. And I'll talk about this more on my show, The Bituation Room, tomorrow, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern. But look, Bernie's a massive disappointment on this. And I think it's important to understand, look, Bernie spent a lot of time on a kibbutz in Israel. He has seen the beauty that could be Israel, that was perhaps when he was younger in a certain moment. That Israel's gone right now. That Israel's been replaced by an apartheid state. It has been replaced by massive civilian casualties, the cruel and deliberate targeting of children, of injured people, of ambulance convoys. And so whatever Bernie's got going on, yes, October 7th was heinous, all right? But there is a 10 times more of a problem that is, or in October, how many October 7ths do we need? So here's the last thing I'll say. I think Bernie's moment is done, okay? A lot of young people are looking at him and saying, no, sorry, my dude, not you, us. And it is our time. It is the time for AOC. It's the time for Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Cori Bush, and all the other squad members who have said ceasefire in no uncertain terms. And yeah, look, if you needed any more proof, AIPAC retweeted Bernie Sanders saying we don't need a ceasefire, we need a humanitarian pause. I mean, that what a terrible way to have your legacy or part of it be undone. But you know, I can't criticize the guy too much. I just think the sun has set on him being relevant, especially on this issue.
Yeah, or especially on this issue. I mean, there can certainly be issues that he can galvanize, you know, segments of the population on. And it's not like, you know, 5 years ago, he was the best ever on every issue. But yeah, as we go through more periods like this, particularly periods where progressives have been out of power for so long and we're so desperate to have progressives stand up, yeah, it's disconcerting. And I'm glad, you know, as you mentioned, there are a number of progressives who have been much better on this particular issue. Of course, many of them have issues on other issues. So the issue is that we're in a rough position as a political movement. But when the stakes are as high as they obviously are, and going forward will continue to be, you want a stronger message. And the media is obviously, we don't have time to go into the video, unfortunately, but the media is obviously looking at it as an opportunity to be like, oh, now we can turn to a news cycle about how terrible and unacceptable Rashida Tlaib is. How dare she be angry about all of this violence? And that will be the news cycle. That what she said, the words she used, that's the thing you should be angry about. Not, you know, if a hospital gets blown up or if a refugee camp gets bombed with 2,000-pound bombs or something. Forget about that for a little bit. And we're going to focus on this. And that just, it's so unsurprising coming from the American media, but just so disgusting at the same time.
But John, last thing, I'm like, imagine if we were in any other time, like if, what if the Holocaust were playing out? I mean, are we just sitting around saying, I don't know, should you call it a Holocaust? I don't know. Let's sit and talk about it some more. F you. Like, where is your soul? Where is your heart? Like, where are you living? Clearly clear of bombs, of Israeli hellfire coming down on your house. Like, you're sitting high on the hog if you have time to be like, I don't know, are there enough dead to call it a genocide? I am so disgusted by this narrative.
Yeah, you know, let alone, you know, the apparently the pressure being put on Egypt to accept a ton of people from Gaza, right, let alone what we're going to get into with the Republicans. Yeah, just utterly devastating. I've never found it to be difficult, but it seems to be, when I look out there at so many other people, to be consistent on wanting civilians to not be killed in mass numbers. Kind of feel like we could apply it here and Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. That doesn't seem so complicated. Clearly, I'm missing something. I have been gone for a while. Maybe there's something I'm missing about this, because lots of people seem to have a big problem with that. But first, it always seems so simple to me. Maybe I'm stupid. Maybe I'm simple-minded. Maybe that's the explanation. I don't know. Anyway, with that said, why don't we turn, there's more of this and there will continue to be more of this. You can rest assured, perhaps we'll cover it more tomorrow, but let's jump now into this. Donald Trump's former Secretary of the Interior has a plan now when it comes to Palestine and Israel. The plan is to expel Palestinians from the United States. This is Representative Ryan Zinke. He has a bill that seeks to do a number of different things. Here are some of the components of it. So Palestinian Authority passport holders would be made inadmissible to the United States. So if you're trying to get out of this active war zone, no. You can stay there, according to him. A number of other components there, but also revoking visas. That's fun, because then obviously, you'd be sending people outside of the country. Where would you be sending them? Well, to the active war zone, where they and their families might die. Maybe Ryan Zinke hasn't thought about that, or maybe, in fact, he has. Maybe that's the whole plan. Now, should we be more mad at Representative Zinke than Donald Trump, who is saying he wants to do these sorts of things were he to become president again? I don't know. I think there can be a lot of anger to go around, but pretty disgusting. We're seeing, as Francesca mentioned earlier in the show, both anti-Semitic as well as Islamophobic attacks and harassment on the rise. And it's never a good position to be in when some of the most powerful and influential people in politics are trying to use government policy to write into law the acceptance of this sort of hate and harassment, making it acceptable to say that no, these people, they don't belong here. They shouldn't be here. They should go back there and likely die, or at the very least suffer. Mm-hmm. So again, like so much else in the news, Francesca, not exactly surprising, but reprehensible to see that this is what the Republican majority in the House is using their time for.
Yeah, obviously this is 9/11 all over again, except the United States wasn't the country being attacked, just our proxy in the Middle East that has been a massive liability for us for however many decades now. And yet we still support it with, $3 billion a year on average, although now it's gonna be a little bit different this year. The funniest part about expelling Palestinian Americans, if there was any funny part, because it's actually incredibly sad and grim and awful and xenophobic, is that where you would ostensibly expel them to is the West Bank or Gaza, where Israel, your homie, is systematically trying to get them out of. So which is it? Zinke needs to get on board because his buddies in the Israeli government and the right in Israel want to get the Palestinians out. Now, are you going to put them in Egypt? That's another thing, right? Or in the Sinai Peninsula, which apparently, according to leaked documents, is where the Israeli government thinks that a bunch of Palestinian refugees should live, just in the desert. Now, that'd be cool. Live off UN That's humanitarian fun. Aid. So it's just so absurd, and also points to the fact that these are stateless folks. Look, if you're a Jewish American, you have the right of return to go move to Israel. Right now, you can go and move there. You can get a citizenship, Israeli citizenship. If you are Palestinian and you were evicted from your home, or your family was, or you in the West Bank, people are being evicted every single day now, and we're not talking a lot about what's happening in the West Bank. You come to America, you go to somewhere else. Can you go back? No, you cannot.
Yeah. Look, having political actors taking this opportunity where they should be showing leadership and trying to stop the violence, instead using it to just reassure their base that they hate these people as much as you do. Just disgusting. Welcome back for me to American politics. Okay, everybody, I'm back. If you're just joining us now, I'm John Iadarola. Some of you might vaguely remember me. Some of you have never seen me before. I'm hoping that I'll fit in well on this channel. If not, they'll probably just go back to the prior hosts. I'm the new guy. I know that I'm going to get hazed and everything. But anyway, we have news to get to. Hit the like button if you haven't already, and let's jump into this.
For four straight years under the Trump administration, I kept America safe. I kept Israel safe, and I kept the entire world safe. We were safe. We had nothing. All over the planet, our enemies knew that if you try to kill our citizens, we will kill you. If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of your blood. That's what it was. And it wasn't a threat. That was just the way it was going to have to be.
I did not miss that, actually. While Donald Trump was president, he's making clear there, we were protected and the world was safe. There was no violence. There were no terror attacks. There were no mass shootings. There were no global conflicts that we were involved in that we, in fact, escalated. And also, we were safe holistically, not just in a military sense. We were safe, except for that one thing that capped off his presidency. I remember something. I feel like a lot of people died, like an apocalyptic amount of them. I don't remember, and he sure seems to be wagering that you all will forget. But that's Donald Trump. Look, he's talking to a Republican gathering. All of the contenders for the presidency are there. We're gonna get into more of it, but yeah, I hadn't really necessarily missed hearing him speak, Francesco. What do you make of his argument for why he should return to the presidency?
I just want to say, John, the blackface is new, though. Like him going like full blackface with the bronzer, that we have not seen. So he just spent a little too much time in the tanning bed or whatever it is. I mean, what is that? Why are you like a dog that's been burying a bone for like half an hour and you come out like, oh, we spill a drop of a gallon of your blood. Like no one also can be as creepy and funny at the same time. This is like, your executioner. Imagine if your executioner had like Trump voice, I'm gonna spill a gallon of your blood. Like I would be laughing even though I'd be about to die. Like that's what Trump is. But this I think is really what's happening, John. I think you put your finger on it, which is that Trumpers and even sort of like MAGA adjacent folks are coming back around to Donald Trump. Like, hey, should we try this again? And it's like, no, we absolutely should not. But it's because of COVID that I think people ignoring COVID and what happened and how he completely mishandled it and truly has American, talk about spilling blood, American blood on his hands, that like folks are just ready to like, oh, but everything before COVID was good. Like, no, it also wasn't good.
Yeah, obviously we could re-litigate the entire thing, but and look here, I'm gonna say something pointless. Hey, that's a big part of what I do on the show. Lots of people died from COVID, but let's not forget that disproportionately, conservatives died.
Yeah.
It's really weird that Republicans don't mind that Trump was responsible for tons of them dying. But he's able to come out and say that sort of BS, that obvious BS to a group that should be incredibly angry at him because of a multi-year PR campaign by the right, by right-wing media, both establishment and independent, the exact same thing, to tell their audience that you should not care about the fact that our policies are killing you. You should, in fact, think that anything that would stop that from happening is the bad thing. And he's benefiting from that. That said, we want to get into some of the other comments that he made on other topics. So let's jump into this.
You'd have millions of people alive right now if the election wasn't rigged. They'd be alive. Ukraine, Israel, the attack would have never been made. All these people would be alive. The cities would be thriving. For those people that talk about Mexico, you know, I said Mexico is going to pay for a piece of the wall. They paid for much more than that. They gave us 28,000 soldiers because there was no way legally they could pay for our wall. You know, they tried to work that, but they paid much more. We have to be strong, and we can't let these people push us around when it comes to election time because we have all the votes we need. I tell people when we put them on, don't help me with the votes. We have the votes.
Man, they will really buy anything. Okay, so millions of people would be alive if the election hadn't been rigged, which wasn't. And he mentions Ukraine, he mentions Israel. I don't know where the rest of the millions is supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, the vaccine clearly has killed every celebrity that's died in the last few years. But look, it's insane conspiracist gobbledygook. It's what you should expect. It felt like the response was actually kind of subdued. Again, there's this weird situation right now where, look, I went into my leave expecting that I would come back and maybe there would be something to shake up the race. There really hasn't seemed to be, but not because he suddenly is, you know, as vibrant and beloved as he was. There seems to be this sort of like, I don't know, semi-depressed just acceptance of the fact that he's going to be their nominee.
Right.
And in fact, they're still willing occasionally to turn on him. Now, bear in mind where they were doing this, but take a look what happened when he decided to really focus on the COVID thing and talk about those governors on the Republican side who had done a good job when it came to COVID. You'll notice that he leaves a name off the list and look at the response to that.
We did a great job in COVID. We never got the credit for the job we did. We let Republican governors keep their states open. Many of them did. Henry McMaster, South Carolina, did a great job. South Dakota did a great job. Tennessee did a great job. A lot of them. They kept them open. No? I will say this. Every Republican governor did much better than the best Democrat governor. It's true.
That's literally not true. Like, look, I'm not just saying that as like a progressive on the internet or whatever. You can literally look up the death rate per 100,000. Like Florida's, I don't know, 12, 14 out of 50. The states with the lowest deaths are predominantly blue states. Look, this is not a matter of opinion. 87,141 log deaths from COVID in Florida. Far, far more, tens of thousands more than it needed to have under any sort of normal circumstance, including a relative of mine. So look, I think it makes sense for Trump to leave DeSantis off the list. DeSantis didn't do a good job. But of course, the reason he's leaving him off the list doesn't have anything to do with how many Floridians needlessly died from COVID. It's just his attempt to besmirch Ron DeSantis. And you'll notice, Francesca, he did not like the fact that they booed him there. He paused for quite a while. He seemed stricken by it.
I mean, the COVID thing is blowing my mind. It still blows my mind. And what really blows my mind is the way that even Democrats run from this issue as if they weren't the party that actually did take it seriously. And they should be touting how few deaths there are, which I know is a really morbid thing to say. But that's what they're, I mean, they're claiming the opposite. These are governors who let their elderly and everyone just die, line up outside for vaccines in the cold, like it was, you know, a concert. Go after the woman responsible for logging the deaths in Florida, right? Raid her home. Like, and so I'm not as mad as Trump. I'm mad at Democrats. And we just got off talking about how Biden is so weak when it comes to even trying to leverage US power against Israel's war right now and rein it in a little bit. And then you just listen to Trump for like 30 seconds and you're like, look, it's fascism. But at least he actually believes in something. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, and this is why I think people like Trump, whereas you see Biden, you're like, look, your policies are there. Can you talk like you believe in something, my dude?
Yeah.
Just a little bit. Say something with conviction.
Yeah, get a B12 shot before you speak. Just burn through the last couple of years you have. You may not have as many if you really amp up the energy, but since you're insisting on running, we would like a little bit of energy. Okay, super fast. Let's go to this Chris Christie sot. We're gonna jump ahead to the last sot just because if you thought Trump got booed, he's got nothing on Chris Christie.
Yeah. Well, now it feels like home. Thank you all very much. Let me first thank the chairman and everyone here. Yep. Look. What a shock. You're for Trump. I'm going to fall over dead. Now look, every one of those boos, every one of those catcalls, every one of those yells will not keep it. Yes, sure. Will not solve one problem we face in this country. Will not solve. And will not make this country better. Your anger against the truth is reprehensible.
Look, I don't know how much longer Chris Christie's presidential bid is going to last. He has not made any headway, despite the fact that he seems like if the Republicans just wanted a guy who's going to get in and give them the same exact substantive policies that Trump would when it comes to tax cuts and things like that. But maybe not cause a scandal, you know, every 37 minutes, that he would do better. But I like that he is at least using these remaining months when he is a candidate to just point out the undeniable, which is, they hate the truth. They hate reality. That is the core of their ideology, that and tax cuts, conspiracism and tax cuts. And understand, he's at this like Republican rally or whatever. So maybe we can say that those people aren't representative, but But we've looked at the polls. We know that they are. This party is broken, not just the elected representatives and the leaders, but much of the base are fundamentally divorced from reality and showing no desire, even post 2020, post COVID, post the election loss, post all of these trials, no desire whatsoever to reacquaint themselves with the real world.
No, why would you want to reacquaint? The real world sucks. No,
that's a good point.
But to be honest with you, I like, as a comic, I see this, like your little 5 minutes in a crowd that absolutely hates you, which I've never really had, but like, I want that so bad to be in a room full of like idiot MAGA and safe guys. I know a lot of you are like, oh, subject you. No, I want to be safe. Don't stalk, don't be weird. But I want to like be able to troll them live to their face. And I feel like Chris Christie should have gone way harder because it's such a fun job to be able to be like, oh yeah, how many indictments? 91. Okay. Did he keep the documents for show and tell? Like, you know, just like, you know, I know a lot of you are first graders, so you're very acquainted with show and tell. Like at that point, you just lay in. And here's the thing about laying into a really rowdy audience. If you troll them and hard enough, they actually start to like you. Everybody Google when we're done, Bernie Mac, I ain't scared of you MFers. The one of the best owns of an audience that absolutely hate, everyone was bombing. They hate Bernie Mac, even though Bernie Mac's a genius, and you watch him turn it around. Bill Burr has a similar thing. So anyway, it just reminds me of a comic, and I'm just like, come on, Chris Christie, turn around and like lay into them because they'll respect you if you dunk on them really, really hard. They might. Yeah. They might.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they obviously like being punished in a variety of ways by their elected yes, representatives.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not judging. Some people are kink. But anyway, Chris Christie, you're putting up, I guess, an okay fight. But yeah, I think you're going to be following Mike Pence in not much longer. Anyway, that said, we do have to take our second break. The time of this hour rapidly running out, but we'll be back with more.
We're going to replay this right now so we can all see it together, what just happened.
Donald Trump being very close-lipped, keeping his cards close to the chest about what's going on as he testifies, literally as we're recording this, in his civil fraud trial in New York City. The issue, though, is that his little thing where he's like, not going to say anything. We still know what you said in there. There's reporters in there. Like, it still comes out. And the things you say to the judge can still damage you, even if you don't admit them to the reporters later. This guy really does believe that PR is the most important thing in the universe. And maybe he's right. But from some of the leaks of what's come out inside of there with Trump on the witness stand, maybe not so much. So we know that the judge threatened to remove him from the witness stand, to potentially throw him out of the courtroom unless the lawyers got him under control. And he was really fighting his lawyers. And I don't know if they were really up to the task since most of them are barely lawyers to begin with. Right. But here's a few of the highlights. The judge asked his lawyer to control Trump, says that if he can't, the judge will excuse him and draw negative inferences. See, the thing about that is, it's similar to what would have happened if he had like taken the fifth, which you know he and his family and the Trump organization often do. But this is not a criminal trial. This is a civil trial. And the way that it works is that if you do that, if you refuse to testify, or if your behavior is such that you are booted out of the courtroom, then the judge is actually allowed in this case to draw negative inferences from that. In a criminal trial, it's very different. You're not supposed to, you know, like prejudge or whatever based on that sort of thing. But it could hurt him here. And that would be if he didn't talk. He is actually talking, and some of that is hurting him. So he was asked about why he decided to drop the value of Seven Springs, one of his properties in New York. He said, I thought it was high. That is admitting that he is involved in the process of determining valuations of his real estate and adjusting those valuations, which is, of course, core to this entire case. And he wants to say, I'm not a part of it. Mm-hmm. And even his family, they towed the same line. His son saying that it was accountants that had made all of these decisions. But he also is so easy to bait into either admitting the truth or wanting to prove that he's powerful and in charge that he basically admitted it there. He was asked about a change in a figure on a 2017 spreadsheet. He said it probably came in his direction because he thought it was too high. He was asked about involvement in 2021 and he said, well, in that case, I wasn't there because I was busy being president, focused on China, Russia, keeping our country safe. Of course, he was not actually president in 2021, so there's a little bit of an issue there. But we don't know exactly how the judge is going to end up ruling on this. And bear in mind, it's the judge who will decide, not a jury. And he's facing something like a $250 million judgment. But so far, his testimony does not seem to have done him any favors. Francesca, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right about the, like, he can't help himself, and especially when it comes to money. Everything else, he's willing to kind of like, you know, plead the fifth, not talk about, you know, dispute or whatnot. But this goes to the core of like what he fancies himself, which is a businessman, you know, like a bad businessman, clearly, if you have to lie and cheat and have, you know, bankrupted casinos and all of the horrible things and stupid things that he's done in his career. But this is really how to get him. Like, I think this trial hurts him the most out of everything, like him personally. And so being like catching him in this, you know, and him having to say, like, abdicate his power and be like, no, I wasn't making those choices. It was somebody else. Like, that, I think, hurts him to say, and it pains him. And so you can really easily catch him out on being like, oh, because I thought it was too high. Oh, because I needed the money. Oh, because I didn't actually have the money, so I thought that they would invest if I told them I was worth more. Oops. Well, because I wanted to be on Forbes 500 list. You know, like all the dumb, petty reasons he wants to overinflate his assets.
It, you know, like for my whole life, I've seen movies that end in these dramatic courtroom scenes where like the lawyer's clever or persistent and they get the person to admit something, like A Few Good Men. And I've always thought, like, people are not going to just suddenly break down and admit it in front of a court. They know where they are.
Right.
But now seeing Trump, like, I don't know, maybe people are easy to manipulate in that way. And maybe it won't hurt him. You know, like the father from the fall of the House of Usher, he has been largely insulated from consequences for his willful criminal actions throughout his life. But in this case, the judge already seems to have a major issue with him. He has been attacking the judge before, during, and after his testimony. This could end up hurting him, and in a way that actually matters financially, hundreds potentially of millions of dollars. Maybe, you know, the beginning of the end for his business empire, but that remains to be seen. Any other thoughts, Francesca?
Just that it's incredible to me that going into 2024, we have a person who is, I would say, 10 to 20 times more dangerous than he was in 2016. Like, just someone who will have however many court cases, however much money to pay out, trying to avoid prison time. Like, I'm so numb to Trump at this point, and yet he grows scarier and worse by the day as he gets more and more desperate. And as the walls close in on him, the White House is literally his last refuge.
Yeah. And look, we don't even have time to talk about, we were going to talk about this, the new reports coming out of him and his allies plotting revenge against everyone. Every single person is going to be investigated, you know, by the Trump administration, including Biden, including all of the right wing critics of him. The fact that they're already drafting plans to deploy the military on his first day in office if there's any civil demonstrations. Not violence, not, you know, like January 6th, just if people are organizing, then they're going to crush it because that's what his base wants to see. Like, we barely have time to talk about the horrific fascist plans that he and his allies have for the next time around. But buckle up, because as we're going to get into in the beginning of the aftermath, there is a very real chance that he is president once again, maybe for a long time. Stay tuned. We're going to find out about that. Now, with that said, that is the first hour done, passed so fast. I had forgotten how quickly that they can go by. And you might be thinking, no, you just got back. Don't go. I want more news. Well, we have more news for you. It's coming up in the aftermath. So if you're on the podcast or something like that, tune in live. And you can always catch that as well as the clips on YouTube on demand. So all of that and more coming up very soon. Continue sending in your comments. And Francesca and I will be back very soon.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.